Well, good evening and welcome back. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate the visitors. Thankful for your attention. And I encourage you to take out a Bible and follow along. Make certain that what is said is in accordance to God's Word. And if it is, I hope that you will strive to apply it to your lives. This evening, we're going to spend some time talking about a message that I am confident applies to everyone here. We're going to talk about the message of suffering. And everybody has had to deal with suffering. Everybody knows somebody who has had to deal with suffering. And it is, in fact, a challenge to our faith. And what we're going to look at is John chapter 11. And we're going to be spending our time looking at Lazarus as he relates to this philosophical, spiritual, and personal issue of suffering. A long time ago, there was a guy by the name of Epicurus. And he was a philosopher in Athens, Greece. He died around 270 BC, which means 270 years before Jesus, there was a guy by the name of Epicurus. And he was a philosopher that had such a potent impact on people that when we get to Acts chapter 17 and verse 18, and Paul is going through the city of Athens, and he's having a debate with people. He has a debate with some Stoics, and a debate with Epicureans. These are people who are following the message of a philosopher 300 years before. And they're still holding to his message. And you can expect that his message then would resonate, that it would make some sense. And a lot of it makes sense to us today still. For example, he would say something along the lines of, "The key to happiness is not what you have, it's appreciating what you have." Right? We understand that. That contentment is not getting everything you want, it's wanting what you have. Right? And so he is somebody we could relate to in that regard. But there are other parts that were really challenging. For example, his debate with Paul, when Paul's arguing with the Epicureans, they look at Paul and he's an absolute fool to them. Because one of their keys is, live a life that is happy. That is, live a life that doesn't have pain. And Paul, in my opinion, was ugly. I don't know that he was always ugly, but at some point they start throwing rocks at Paul until they think he's dead. They start punching Paul and beating Paul and he gets in shipwrecks. Paul has had a rough life. He bears the brand marks of Christ on his body. And he keeps preaching the message that causes that pain in his life. And from their perspective, that is the utmost of foolishness. Well, there's one other thing Epicurus said. And so regards to this issue of evil, and it's revealed to us by David Hume, quotes him years later, but says, Epicurus said, "Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then from whence comes evil?" When I was in philosophy class, we learned something very similar, and it's the basic argument of evil or of suffering. They're basically the same thing. I know evil and suffering are different, but most people, when they're arguing about evil, they're really arguing about pain. Why does this bad thing happen to good people? Well, we've heard this in a different little argument, but it's, if God is all-powerful and God is all-loving, then there would be no suffering. But there is suffering, then therefore either God is not all-loving or God is not all-powerful. And ultimately what they're going to say is, there is no God. Now, some people, they're not going through the philosophical argument, but they come to the same conclusion. They suffer and they either conclude, God doesn't exist because if there was a God, I wouldn't go through this. Or they just reject Him because they're going through it. Say, I give up on God. It's not worth following Him. It's not worth serving Him. I was thinking about this problem of suffering. Epicurus, now that's 270 years before Jesus. That argument already existed. And I'm not convinced that in John chapter 11, when it talks about Lazarus, that argument was not specifically being targeted because of the things that are stated in this chapter. Now, really quickly, I just want to point out that we have to be careful about accusing God and saying, all right, if God lets there be suffering, then He's not all loving. If God lets there be suffering, then He's not all powerful. We are not God's judge, and we do not fully understand God. So just understand that this is that's not a really good approach to things. We don't want to go down that path. Nonetheless, let's look at what God's revealed to us. And so John chapter 11 is the account of the resurrection of Lazarus. And I think most of us are fairly familiar with it. We're still going to read a good chunk here in just a little bit, but it is a chapter that is filled with suffering. But understand that it's a chapter that's filled with Jesus and suffering. And Jesus, in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3, is the exact representation of God's nature. In other words, what Jesus said in John chapter 14, show us the Father. And Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you know me, you know the Father. In other words, you want to know how God deals with suffering? Look at Jesus. Look at John 11. It's a chapter about suffering. There is an illness that leads to death. And there is the sorrow of the family that's left behind. And Jesus is going to interact with all of that. And I'll be honest, it's a little surprising, some of the things he says. It's a little challenging. But I want you to keep this in mind. All right, is God all-powerful or is God all-loving? What's going on? So John chapter 11, we're going to read 44 verses starting in verse 1. And we're thinking about this particular problem of suffering as we read it. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sisters sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. This he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep. The disciples then said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. Therefore Thomas, who is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, so that we may die with him. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Martha then said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? So she said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. When she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. And he said, Where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews were saying, See how he loved him. But some of them said, Could not this man, who opened the eyes of the blind man, have kept this man from dying? So Jesus, again being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, Remove the stone. Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. Now, there's some surprising things in there. We see Jesus, the exact representation of God. He finds out that there is something going on with Lazarus. And did you see the first thing he did? Nothing. 2 days. The disciples see this. Now, they don't understand it at the time, but later on, they're going to be able to think back and see that Jesus hears about his friend suffering, and his response is to spend 2 days doing something else. I don't know what he did. Eating meals, sleeping, talking to people. I don't know what it was. But his disciples know he chose that over Lazarus. If I got a phone call right this moment, my phone is usually on silent during sermons, but there's one person who can make my phone ring, and that's Bonnie, my wife. And if I get a call from her and I find out that she's been in an accident, you think I'm going to finish the sermon and continue this gospel meeting? Nope. Gospel meeting's done. I got to go home. That's what I would do. It's not what Jesus did. 2 days. Now, I will tell you, though, that if Bonnie calls me and tells me she's been in a fender bender, we're going to go through with the gospel meeting, right? That's not a very serious thing. But that's not what happened with Jesus. Jesus knows this illness is serious. Jesus knows he's going to die. Jesus is the one who announces it. Lazarus is dead. Jesus knows this is serious and still waits 2 days. And you know what else he says? And I imagine this would have been hard for Mary and Martha to hear come from his lips if they had ever known that he said this. I'm glad I wasn't there. But that's what he said in verse 15. I'm glad. That's hard to hear. But they keep saying three times in there, if you were counting, three times this basic statement is made. If you had been here, what they're saying is, Jesus, you could have prevented this. Put another way, Jesus, you let this happen. And you want to know something? They're right. He let it happen. And isn't that a polite way of saying, where were you? Where was God when this was happening in my life? Why did you let this happen? Isn't that basically our question? How can he be God and have the power or the love? How can he let this happen? Well, Jesus does let it occur, but look at our two basic arguments. He's either not all-powerful or he's not all-loving. What is emphasized throughout this chapter? His power. This didn't happen because of a lack of power. Everybody understands he has the power. They run to him for help because they know he can solve the problem. At the end of in John chapter 11, verse 37, the people standing by said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying?" They're like, "We know he has power. He healed that man who was born blind. He can do this." John chapter 11 is not the story of the one man who got the one sickness that Jesus couldn't solve. He has the power. And honestly, they're selling the situation short. And I don't know why they are. These are disciples. At least Mary and Martha are close disciples of Jesus. They should have known better. You would think they would have heard of what happened in Luke chapter 7. Remember where there's that centurion who has a slave that's sick, and the centurion comes, and he comes to Jesus and says, "Could you come help?" And Jesus says, "Yeah, I'll go to your house." And he says, No. You don't have to do that. See, I'm a man of power, and I understand how this works. I tell my slave to do something, and he goes and he doesn't. I don't have to go do it. All you have to do is say it, and it'll happen. And that's exactly what happens. Jesus says, "You've got great faith." And then he says it, and the man is healed. Here's how John 11 could have happened. First verse, they come to Jesus. They say, "Lazarus is sick." And he says, "No, he's not." The story's done. That could have been it. Absolutely, Jesus let this happen. He absolutely has the power to stop it. And he doesn't have to be there to prevent it. And if there was any doubt about his power over this particular illness, when the man dies in 4 days and everybody says he's now got a stench, he has now decayed, Jesus just says, "Come forth," and he does. There's no question about his power. And along with that, there's no question about his authority, because everybody still understands, "You're still Lord." They watch him wait 2 days, but his disciples repeatedly call him Lord. They call him teacher and rabbi. "We still want to listen to you." Even not just those disciples, but everybody else is still calling him Lord. Over and over and over through this chapter, they come to Jesus. They call him Lord. They call him Lord. They call him Lord. And then you have Martha and her amazing statement down in verse 27. Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. Now, they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why Jesus is behaving the way he is. Why Jesus has let this man suffer and let this man die. They don't understand why they're experiencing all this pain, but they know this: it hasn't changed who he is. He's still the Lord. He's still the Christ. He's still from God. He's still the Son of God. So, all powerful? That's not in question. He has the power. So it must be love, and what is the emphasis throughout this chapter? From the beginning to end, look how much he loves. I mean, it starts off in verse 3. The sister sent word to him saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." And if we had any doubt, it's then just stated as fact in verse 5. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yes, he loved them. And in verse 33, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. And then in verse 35, we see him weeping. And what does everybody think about that? Look, he loved him. There's no question about the love. Jesus has taken this supposed perfect argument. If God's all-powerful and all-loving, there won't be suffering. And here we have all-powerful, all-loving, and still suffering. He's thrown the whole thing up on its head. He had the power to prevent the suffering, but it still happened. He had the love, but it still happened. So what's the answer? Wouldn't you just love it if the rest of the sermon was, "Here's the answer to the problem of suffering"? We're going to shoot for it. But I'm not going to give it all to you. I don't know all the answers, but I do know some things. I know what Epicurus has wrong. I know what everybody else is missing. Two things. One, we keep looking at the short term. We keep looking at just the small little picture rather than the big story. Is John chapter 11 a sad chapter? It has sorrow. It has pain. But this is a happy story. Because in the end, Lazarus lives. And those are the kind of movies I like. I don't understand Bonnie and sometimes other women that like the movies that at the end they're just crying and they're so sad. I don't get that. I like the movies where, yeah, there's all sorts of struggles and difficulties, but at the end, everybody's happy. I like those. This is that. Almost. There's a few people that are really upset that Lazarus lives. We're ignoring them. For everybody else, everybody who's reasonable and compassionate and kind, this is a happy story filled with sorrow and pain to get there. See, the Bible teaches us to look at the big picture. Not at the moments of pain and sorrow, but to look at the end of it. In Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, this famous verse tells us that all things work together for good to those who love Him and have been called according to His purpose. You know, that's been horribly misread and misused. Somehow, and I don't know how this happened, and I don't know exactly for how long this has happened, but somebody read that passage and thought it said all things are good, and that's not what it says. But I've talked to so many people who have gone through suffering, and they have suffered even more at the hands of well-meaning Christians, who instead of giving words of comfort, give words that stab somebody who's already in pain. Because they got it in their head that everything that happens, somehow, some way, if you just see it in one way, it's actually good. Oh. I know a young man overseas who decided he was going to preach. And so he starts preaching for the Lord in a distant land. Finds a good woman and he marries this beautiful wife. And she's pregnant and things are going so well. But the pregnancy falls apart. His son dies. His wife is to this day still in a coma. This is years now. You want me to go to him and say it was good that your son died? That it's good that your wife is non-responsive? That's not good! There's nothing good about that. It's not good that Lazarus is dead. That's not what Romans 8 and verse 28 says. What Romans 8 and verse 28 says, we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God. What he's saying is the end, the big picture, at the end, it's going to be good. It's going to be worth it. Now, she actually understood that. Martha did. Because when Martha comes to Jesus in John chapter 11, and John chapter 11 and verse 21, Martha then said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give to you. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. She says, I know. In the end, it's going to be okay. In the end, it's going to be good news. But you know, when you're dealing with God, it doesn't have to be the end when everything's fixed. Jesus is saying, we're not waiting till the last day. I am the resurrection. I'm going to fix it today. That's why we pray to God, because He has the power to fix it today. I don't know if He will, but He has the power to. He's the solution. Sometimes it happens immediately, but for Christians, the comfort is knowing the end. Knowing that when it's all said and done, the Christian's life is not a tragedy. It's a happy story. I do not believe that anybody will go to heaven and be in the light of God's presence, experience the joy of heaven, a place where there is no more tears, No more death, no more pain, no more agony. I don't believe anybody will go there, no matter what they suffered in this life, no matter how long they suffered, no matter how intense it was, no matter how incredibly unjust it was. Nobody's going to get to heaven and say it wasn't worth it. The end is what makes our story good. All things work together for good. I also know that what's being missed in this argument is that suffering can have purpose. There's purpose behind it. Now, that's not always encouraging, because sometimes what that means, and emphasis on this word sometimes, but sometimes what that means is your pain is your fault. I mean, that's what Jesus says in John chapter 5 and verse 14. He heals a man who had been a paralytic. He runs into him again and he gives him this warning. He says, "Behold, you have become well. Do not sin anymore so that nothing worse happens to you." If something worse happens to him, why did it happen? Because he sinned. Sometimes suffering is because we've done something wrong. It's a consequence of our own actions, but not always. Not always. Again, I hear the most terrifying things that sometimes Christians say. I heard of a woman who had a miscarriage. It's a devastating moment. And somebody came up to her, some Christian comes up to her and says, "What'd you do wrong?" And she's not asking, you know, what did you do something physically wrong to cause it? She's asking, did you do something spiritually wrong? Actually, in her sense of comforting, this woman who is feeling the suffer of loss of a child comforts her by saying, "It's your fault." Oh, there's no comfort there. That was Job's friend's concept. But that's not always the way it is. In John chapter 9, sometimes suffering has a different purpose. His disciples asked him, there's a man who's been born blind in verse 1. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him." So they're struggling with it. They're like, how on earth? Sin is what causes suffering. This man's born suffering. That doesn't make sense. He couldn't have been sinning before he was born, but his parents aren't the ones who are suffering. How does this make sense? And Jesus answers and says, "You're missing it entirely. That has nothing to do with it. There's something else." You want to know something? I feel pretty confident about this. Maybe you'll agree, maybe you'll disagree. I think you'll probably be pretty confident about it too. When this man was born, the parents did not say, "I know why he's blind." There's a purpose. We almost never know what it is. Doesn't mean there isn't one. There's a purpose, but we almost never know what it is. Well, just as a side, don't ever go to somebody and accuse them of suffering because of their sins. It doesn't always work that way. And in John chapter 11 with Lazarus, there's a purpose. And I think it matters. So in John chapter 11 and verse 4, after Jesus hears about this, Jesus heard this, he said, "This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." The purpose of this illness, the purpose of this pain was not death. It was glory. Verse 15, Jesus did not say, "I am glad Lazarus died." Jesus didn't say, "I am glad Lazarus's brother and sisters are in pain." What he said was, "I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe." There was purpose. In verse 40 and 42, Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it so that they may believe that you sent me." And we stopped in verse 44, but in verse 45 it says, therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. And then in John chapter 12, verse 9 and 11, it says, the large crowd of the Jews then learned that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. But the chief priests planned to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Jesus. Now, if we could reach up into heaven for a moment and take Lazarus from that glorified state and put him on this stage, and if we asked him, was it worth it? And he could start listing off people that are in heaven right now because of his few days of pain. What do you think his answer would be? And if we brought Mary and Martha down, and we asked them, if you could, knowing all you know now, would you do it again? What do you think their answer would be once they see the big picture? Was the pain awful? Yes. It hurt. It was real. But it was worth it. Souls were saved. I don't know what the purpose is for our suffering. When I suffer, I don't know why. But I can know this, there is a reason. And more importantly, mine is not a tragedy. My life is a victory, a story of success, a story that ends with eternity in the presence of God. So the answer to suffering, first, don't give up on Jesus. Don't give up on God. What if John chapter 11 was different? What if Lazarus gets sick and Mary and Martha see him and they see how bad it is and they get mad at God for it? And don't send anybody to Jesus. I don't get angry at people when they get angry at God. Job gets angry and nobody rebukes him for that. I understand. I think God understands the anger. I understand that people don't always understand why it's going on. But the worst thing you could do is give up on the only one who has the solution. You can blame God for what's happened, but He's still the solution to your problem. And your problem doesn't change who He is. It doesn't change that He's God. It doesn't change His power. And it doesn't change His love for you. So the worst thing we can do in suffering is to turn our backs on the one solution. But that's not the most powerful, potent lesson from John 11 for me. We spend all this time, well, is God all loving or is God all powerful? Remember, John chapter 11 is Jesus, the exact representation of God, showing us how God handles suffering. How does He handle suffering? He hurts with us. I don't think Epicurus gave any thought to that. John 11 verse 35 is a theologically challenging verse. Jesus wept. And everybody spends all this time, why did Jesus weep? And they go through all these things. If the answer's not in the text, I don't know what the answer is. We're just guessing at that point. Here's all that's in the text. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. The only thing that it said there, to give us any indication as to why he wept, is he saw Mary and Martha hurting. And he hurt too. You know, I don't know that God has ever given us a command He's not Himself willing to do. I mean, we see that so clearly with Abraham. When God tells Abraham, I want you to offer up your son as a sacrifice to me. Now, Abraham didn't even have to do that one actually, but God then showed, I'll do it. And he offered up his son as a sacrifice for us. And God has commanded us, rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. I don't know why people hurt. I don't know why bad things happen. But I know God sees, and He hurts with us. And that's a God I can love. A God I can serve. To the very end. And to see the happy story. The happy ending. When the pain is gone. And we get to be with this God who weeps with those who weep. And rejoices with those who rejoice. I hope that this can be of some benefit to you, of some help, because we all do suffer. And the Bible doesn't just ignore it, and it doesn't just make it really simple. It's a complex issue. But I sure am thankful for what it's told us and how it helps. If you're not a Christian, we encourage you to become one, to be baptized into Christ, to dedicate your life to this God. You know, He's not just the God who suffers with us. He's the God who suffered for us. He went through the pain. He went through the agony for our sake. So that we would turn from our sins, away from our rebellion, and follow Him wholeheartedly. When the people realized that they had crucified the Son of God, in Acts chapter 2, they said, What must we do? And the answer was, Repent, and let each one of you be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. That was the answer then, and it's the answer tonight. And we encourage you to be baptized. If you're a Christian and you have fallen away, don't turn your back on God. He's the only solution to all of your problems. Come back to Him. Remember, He wants you. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?